Well, we have some time now for questions, so the floor is open.
Thanks.
Well, it's just, I've been thinking a lot about this kind of thing, because I've been, I guess right now I'm writing the introduction to my thesis, which is about how suggestion and expectation might operate in meditation experiences. And so what's interesting is if you look back at the literature on transcendental meditation, there are actually a number of studies showing that if you tell people that they're going to have certain kinds of experiences when they meditate, like if you encourage the idea that this kind of meditation is going to influence their autonomic functions, then that actually changes the way that people's bodies respond to the meditation practice. That's just kind of one way that that maybe we could start to think about how these kinds of metaphors and more physiological functions might be interacting in a way that we can track, like, empirically in a lab.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm just excited even thinking so specifically about so many of these issues over the last few days.
I'd be interested to hear more about the thesis, actually. I think there's a whole series of very interesting issues entangled in this. I mean, the whole sort of rethinking of the so-called placebo effect in different recent years, I think, has kind of moved in a somewhat similar direction.
Right.
So Daniel Norman's work on meaning and so on.
And even Benson himself was interested in the ways in which people's beliefs about what they were doing and their ideas, their conceptual frameworks, could actually influence what was happening for them in their practice.
And I mean, for me, this whole business of visualizing and operating with the subtle body, I mean, and what exactly are you doing? Because there, of course, you're quite, in a way, you're doing that deliberately, in that you're imagining things in a particular way, which is expected to have certain effects, rather than imagining things which kind of more or less accidentally, which seems to be the way that we seem to be happy to talk about it in the Western context. Lawrence.
So I just wanted to pick up on what Michael said, because for me, that way of looking at things is a very important bridge between the scientific epistemology that sort of assumes that we're just describing what's there, what's really there. And, you know, if you can't measure it or you can't verify it in some way, it's not there. And that's what we have to work with. So if the there that's there is not simply pre-existing, but is created partly by expectations, by certain imagery, by certain practices, what you're trying to describe is a kind of a loop that is partly constituted exactly by certain metaphors and certain practices and so on. So, and I mean that at least insofar as we're talking about the science of it, in a way that is then very, you know, potentially measurable, potentially can be studied, because you can manipulate people's expectations and you can show that now the experience is different in some important way. So I think that's actually, because there's a big problem, a big epistemic and not to say metaphysical problem between talking about subtle bodies on the one hand and, you know, Western science on the other. These are not really very easy things to put together, but one way you can at least partially put them together, maybe just not very satisfying to people who see the preeminence of the subtle body as, you know, more fundamental ground than all this other stuff, but one practical way, coming back to your question at the end, does it work? And part of that question is what works? Is that what we're talking about is exactly those kinds of looping processes, and processes are, you know, more subtle than fixed structures in some way. So for me, that's, you know, a very practical way to get started on some of this, to bring it into play when we're thinking about working with people, giving them suggestions, encouraging certain kinds of practice, and trying to see what the consequences are.
Yeah. No, I agree. I very much like the way you've put it there, which I think makes it clearer than some of the ways I was trying to talk about it. But certainly, I mean, for me, to see the subtle body as that kind of process, well, that kind of makes a lot more sense than to see it as, you know, some sort of accurate description of the way things are, which I think is very hard to deal with from a Western viewpoint, and which doesn't really work in the Tibetan viewpoint either, because if you look at different traditions, you get different descriptions, and sometimes even the same people working with, say, Chakrasamvara and Kala Chakra, which are two traditions that the same people might well be working with, actually have different models of the subtle body. And this doesn't seem to worry the Tibetans. I think because they're actually not looking for that kind of accuracy or descriptive precision. The assumption is that they are doing slightly different things or different ways to get to the same point or something like that. Sorry. Whichever.
I just want to elaborate a little bit more, because a term that we use very often, in the current discussion, is actually experience, right? But somehow, what do we actually mean when we use this term experience? So, there are so many terms that are interrelated, right? Like consciousness, mind, brain, neural framework, neural network, and experience. And we also use the term subtle body, right? So I'm wondering, here when we say experience, do we only mean something that's conceptual, something that's going on in our mind that can be equated or even reduced to the activity of neurons? Or we are talking about something that is not just something that happened in the mind, but something that is also embodied? So if in that sense, I'm wondering if we could actually approach the subtle body in a different way by somehow interpreting it as an embodied experience. And in that sense, because in phenomenology, there are a lot of discussions on solitary confinement, and they consider that prisoners in solitary confinement, they have something like a social death. But by saying that, they actually mean that part of their experiential structure has been destroyed, but that experiential structure is definitely not just something that's going on in the mind or in the brain, but something that is more like embodied experience, because it definitely entails and involves interactions with others. So in that sense, when some phenomenologists, they're talking about social death, and when they say experience, they actually mean something that is not just about the brain, but also about the body, right? Because experience is definitely embodied. So I'm wondering if we could somehow approach the subtle body in this way.
Yes. I could have made that a little more explicit in the paper. And I think there are people who work along these lines. I mean, the whole inactive tradition of people like Evan Thompson and Francesco Barella before him, in which consciousness is very an experience. You know, these seem very much as things that are taking place not just within body or within the mind, but as part of an interaction with others, with the wider environment, and so on. I'm perhaps taking that a bit too much for granted, partly coming from an anthropological background. But I think it's important to make that point and to keep making that point. These terms are like experience are really problematic. I think I've kind of over the years sort of relaxed into treating words in a sort of slightly scattergun way. You sort of throw them out in approximately the right direction and hope people sort out what you mean, not because that's how do I put it, not because I would not in some way like to be more precise, but because actually, precision often seems to get in the way of enough openness to move the argument on. And so, in a way, I think you have to move backwards and forwards a bit between more precise formulations and more open ones. You can put most of the words I use in quote marks, but it gets a bit tiresome. Okay.
I'd like to know if you could elaborate more on your last question, as long as it works, in terms of what you refer to more precisely, and in terms of, what I wrote you about Buddhist or Tibetan Buddhist ideas of healing. It seems, and also in your presentation, we have the Tibetan Buddhist model, which doesn't aim at healing, it aims at awakening, and then we have the Western models that aim at healing. But nevertheless, if we look for answers to questions of healing in Tibetan Buddhist scriptures or in Buddhist scriptures, we get ideas that go a lot into the use of the body, where it says they were, if they had nuns or monks in the monastery who went insane, they wouldn't recommend meditation, but they would recommend labor. And in the Tibetan system, you have the use of the body in terms of certain exercises to stabilize certain loops, and you even have the postures where through pressure the energies of the loom is supposed to be blocked or stabilized. So how much of those, the body approach and the physical exercise and posture approach is already being adapted in Western systems? Since that is actually the Buddhist answer to healing, that it would make sense to look there for answers rather than in the meditation system.
Well, one Buddhist answer. I mean, of course, in a way, I was somewhat deliberately conflating the medical and meditative traditions in Tibet, partly because I think they do overlap, and there is this very interesting relationship between lung as prana as a process for the a technique for the achievement of enlightenment or awakening, and prana as something that can be imbalanced and so cause disorders. And I mean, on the whole, the medical tradition would tend to approach those through through diet or through medicines, pharmacology, and so on, rather than through exercise. So certainly, you might get a recommendation to do physical labour or something like that. Whereas the tantric tradition has got the whole tradition of specific exercises of various kinds. One recent Western adaptation, you may know it, is a book that again comes from Namke Norbu's tradition of the, which goes through his system of trukho exercises, and with a Tibetan doctor, and discusses health applications of each of them in turn. That was the first time I'd seen anything quite like that in the West, and I thought it was an interesting move, and it'd be interesting to see if it goes further. But obviously, I mean, that's in a sense a logical consequence, and at that point, that does raise the question of, if it works, why are we worried? I mean, there's always the, can I say, as an ex-academic, retired academic, perhaps, I'm increasingly aware these days of the possibility of, because you're an academic, you treat everything as an academic problem. Because you've spent a lifetime playing with theory, then theory comes to seem the answer to everything. And often theory is not necessarily the answer to everything. If you have a technique that appears to function reasonably well, then one can perhaps spend too much time getting entangled in precisely whether the theoretical basis makes sense on the Western side and or the Buddhist side. I suppose it goes back to the Buddha's famous image of, if somebody fires a poisoned arrow at you, do you really have to know who made it and precisely what sort of poison and how it was constructed? You want to do something about it fast. So I've always got a sense in this sort of argument where I think one can maybe push this too far and worry a bit too much about it. But I also feel that it probably is valuable for a number of reasons.
I want to challenge that a little bit, speaking for a moment as a clinician, because I think there's a problem, and part of it's related to what Michael raised earlier, that everything works a little bit because people believe in it. So that doesn't, the minimal level of just working a bit does not give us good grounds for choosing a course of action around health or around something else. We need to know a little bit beyond the fact that it works a little bit, or a friend says, oh, this is great, do this. For mild things, it really doesn't matter, but it's not that we're optimizing. It's just that it doesn't matter. But for serious things, it really does matter. And the fact that something might work a little bit is not enough. So given the fact, though, that we don't know for most kinds of Western healing, most kinds of healing systems around the world, we don't know how well they work in any kind of a rigorous way, we often rely on the plausibility of the theory. We say, okay, we don't know for sure it works, but it makes good sense because that, you know, we all agree on this model. And that then becomes a big challenge if you're operating with a totally different model than something that is either not grounded for another person in their metaphysics or in their bodily experience in some way, so they don't know how to judge that. They're just judging it from authority. So I think it's a role for anthropology, among other disciplines, to sort of critique and analyze that process of authorizing and legitimizing and installing particular epistemic regimes that may or may not be helpful to people. That's the general thing. Does it help you for the particular problem you have? There's another issue related to the same, does it work, which is really, does it work for what? Because most of these things, and palpably meditative practice, so on, is meant to work for many different things, maybe one, you know, in some ultimate sense, one core thing, but many different things. And it's quite possible, quite likely, it seems to me, certain things work well for some things and not for others. Moreover, they might even have a good effect on one thing and a negative effect on others. And there's a kind of discriminating, you know, knowledge, wisdom, whatever is needed to distinguish that. And again, I don't think you get that just from people saying, well, it worked for me when I was sick last week and I took a bunch of vitamin C and it didn't get worse, so obviously vitamin C worked. You know? That's how I know we all operate that way, but it's not the firmest footing for, you know, important decisions about health or anything else.
Oh, well, that's a very useful introduction, but of course... We have a problem, really, because the consistent theory argument, you know, have we got a decent theoretical basis, doesn't actually necessarily work all that well a lot of the time, particularly when it gets added to this question of who decides what a decent theoretical basis is, you know, and then of course you have the other set of criteria which is, you know, evidence-based medicine and the RCTs and so on, which we probably don't want to get into here in much detail, but there you have a set of procedures which work fairly well in terms of doing a certain job, which is basically, I think, a resource allocation job at the end of the day, but which all sorts of medical health-giving procedures or things that seem to work can't be subjected to, or don't, you know, you can't really do an RCT for Chinese medicine or Tibetan medicine. I mean, you can sort of fake it, but for all sorts of technical reasons to do with how it operates, and so with a lot of these things. So, yeah, I wasn't meaning to dismiss the rod of theory altogether. I'm not that kind of retrospectively dismissive of the academic undertaking. I was just placing a little bit of a question mark against how far do we worry about this question of exact correspondence. It comes back a little bit to something that I've thought about a bit over the years, which is the whole question of holding a conversation with another person. And you talk to somebody else, and at some level, you know, if you think about it, that their understandings of the words you're using are different from your understandings of those words, and that there's a very complex question of adaptation and something that is not quite understanding but not quite misunderstanding going on in just about every dialogue. And there again, I mean, we could give up and not talk, but it seems to work after a fashion. Sorry, there are a couple of questions about.
Sure.
Yeah.
Just going off of what Lawrence just mentioned, it seems like it's also an excellent opening for anthropological data or ethnographic project there, because to the extent that Lawrence is saying, we have to look at, you know, is there a serious question of how effective are these different, you know, systems of treatment for specific illnesses? There's also the question of weighing the cultural or political significance of specific illnesses in different cultures, and then whether or not there's even space for those to map onto one another. I'm thinking of, for instance, at McGill we had Margaret Locke, who was looking at the phenomenon of menopause and the way that it gained a lot of traction in the West and became an incredibly significant, I guess, not illness, but process for which people came up with all sorts of medical interventions. And then looking at that same process in Japan and the extent to which menopause and symptoms associated with it didn't, you know, there's not an exact term for it, the process itself, or the symptoms that clustered around that time of age didn't really map onto the experience of the end of menstruation to the same degree that they did here in North America. And then, you know, overall, the amount of weight that people lent to the phenomenon of menopause or to the events that clustered around the end of menstruation kind of fell to the background compared to other major significant events that were taking place at that part of the life course. And I just think it's a really amazing opportunity or opening to look at, maybe in a kind of iterative way, what specific illnesses are being treated with this, you know, this Tibetan medical system, and what is the import of these illnesses in the broader kind of social political context.
Yeah.
As I listen to the discourse, two thoughts come to mind. And this comes from a different maybe worldview. So again, just like you're mentioning, take it with a big grain of salt. Two things. One thing is, you know, meditation, regardless of the type, for the masses, it is a pill. It is a, I'm stress free. It is, even if you do mindfulness, even if you take it to a certain level, it's still a pill. It's still to get healthy. It's still to go from being stressed to being a bit less stressed. Or maybe, oh yes, release the stress. But very far from these kind of ideals of life. The second thing that comes to mind is, and I was teasing Lawrence about this once, is that body, mind, beyond body and mind, it's, you know, silence can't be described in words. We take this body as a thing that exists. We take even the subtle body as a thing that exists. It exists, certainly. We experience it. The Relung explains a lot of phenomena, experience like subjective and objective experience. But ultimately, we can't fully explain, like if we use the mind to explain the mind, we don't do it justice. My argument is, I mean, it's not really an argument. It's like, in a way, there's a futility to the thing, to study it. There's also a joy to it. And I'll end with a little story, is that why are we so concerned about health and absence of health? And we have. We think absence of health is a horrible thing. We think health is a great thing. But, you know, we could play our lives like a game of Monopoly. Okay. So when I play Monopoly, I usually get Mediterranean and Baltic. Because I win that way. But sometimes I lose. But either way, I'm like screaming or swearing. I'm like, yeah, I got it. And then, okay, once in a while I would die. And I'll die painfully in jail. But, so that's it's a, it's just, I'm throwing it
up. We're back to karma.
Yes.
So I think also related to this question of whether something works and understanding the mechanisms. So sometimes something might outperform a sham or a placebo version. Like for instance, in the case of acupuncture, there are pretty good meta-analytic findings showing that sham acupuncture, where you use sham needles that don't actually penetrate in the you know, what's considered appropriate in the tradition. That still has a major placebo effect and still helps people, but actually real acupuncture helps people a bit more. We don't know why. We don't understand why that is, but we still know that it actually does work more than sham acupuncture. So even if we don't understand the mechanism, we can still say that it works as more than just a placebo. And so I think that's another subtlety that's important to keep in mind, is it's not that just because we don't understand how something works that it doesn't have a specific mechanism. Like, there's lots of things that might work better than placebo, but we don't understand why. We still might think that we should use them in clinical practice.
Yeah, thanks.
Yes, I just, it's kind of a rhetorical question, but I wanted to ask if you see these two systems becoming complementary in real life at some point, or maybe they're mutually exclusive, because I think they kind of started in a different place, right? This kind of space of rationality and real life knowledge, and then this kind of more imaginative approach to health, or more abstract. So do you think there is a chance for these two systems kind of merge in some kind of holistic approach that will be implemented in contemporary institutions, you know? Because I think they can really benefit from each other, right? But how much this cultural difference or worldview that is at the core of these two different systems influences the possibilities of that, right? Because I feel there is lots of prejudice on the side of Western medicine towards alternative practices.
Oh yes. Well, I mean, in a sense, I mean, the question of complementary medicine becomes a rather pragmatic one. I mean, if people want to do Tibetan medicine alongside Western medicine, nobody's going to stop them. I mean, short of the problem of finding a Tibetan doctor, which there are not that many of them around even these days. But I think there is a sense in which Tibetan medicine is becoming part of the whole complementary medicine scene on a fairly small scale so far. For me, I'm really rather more interested in, and I'm not sure if that's the sense in which you meant complementary, I'm really more interested in the question of can we have enough of a real encounter at the level of understanding between these systems that they can start to illuminate each other and improve each other, if you like, that it, and perhaps particularly obviously given where we are and where the world is at the moment, this is largely a question of what Tibetan medicine might be able to give to the expanding and widening of Western medical ideas and processes. So in a sense that's more what I'm interested in, whether it's going to happen. I don't think I can foretell the future. I mean, there are obviously people who are interested in it happening, people who are working towards it happening in various ways, and there's also obviously lots more people who aren't interested, and there's a huge economic and political establishment that has interests of its own in all of this, and who knows where it goes, you know.
Thank you. Just also kind of following up question, but is there any research about maybe Tibetan practitioners who are combining Western practices in their healing techniques, or somehow apply also to Western knowledge?
I think this happens quite a lot in that the Tibetan system has already been partly has already been under quite a bit of biomedical influence, particularly in Tibet, but also among the diaspora. So in practice, it's not that pure. And it also, I think, depends a bit on who you're working with. I mean, I did some field work about 20 years ago with a Tibetan doctor in India, and it was interesting how, in many ways, how similar a lot of what was going on was to a Western medical context, including his self-presentation. I mean, this was a guy who was in fact a monk, and he had a sort of red sweater in kind of recognition of that, you know. But he had a stethoscope and a sphygmomanometer, and he was kind of deploying those in a quite kind of, you know. Blood pressure was quite a significant indicator within his practice, because it also reflected the sort of large mixed Indian and Tibetan clientele he was working with in North India, I think. And Tibetan doctors who are operating with Western clienteles who are expecting a much more spiritual presentation might get much less of that kind of thing. You know? I think it does happen, though. How far it happens, I don't know. And, of course, there's also a secondary issue here, which is to do with the legislative regimes under which Asian medical traditions operate in various Western countries. So, I mean, in large parts of Europe, you have to have a Western biomedical training before you can practice Tibetan medicine as well, you know. So you have people who have a combination, whereas that isn't necessarily so in other places.
I think we have time for maybe one more question.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering. Just wondering. Do you think it might, with the mindfulness movement, and I know that we're looking at this sort of stuff and seeing how I'm seeing that it's about to probably enter where I work in Indonesia, as there's a few practitioners that are really excited about it who are now being trained in North America, coming back from their PhDs. We see it in Australia how it's, you know, it is, there's a significant momentum for this, but it is at the level of relaxation or optimization of functioning within a context, within a world that's kind of, you know, going for aims that are very, the antithesis very much so of what Tibetan thought is all about. Do you think there might be some movement beyond that in terms of further application, in terms of insight, in terms of even a mode of scientific inquiry in some ways, because they talk about, in terms of various meditational practices, talk about discovering various aspects of, you know, scientific phenomenon as well, in terms of things and parallel discoveries at a time or even prior to things like discovery of the atom. Certain practitioners talk about those sorts of things that in different historical meditative traditions. Do you think there might it go beyond in terms of those medical practitioners, psychologists, psychiatrists' application of the kind of relaxation type, aim? Will it go beyond that, do you think, or is it going to sort of float around until we get to the next big thing and move on to something else that, you know, that seems to look yeah, you know, quite good in another tradition?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think at one level, obviously, there's a certain element of fad and fashion about the mindfulness movement, and I can't quite imagine that it's just going to keep on expanding in exactly the same way that it's operating. It's already, in fact, changing in all sorts of ways. Partly as a result, of the awareness that's growing of things that go wrong if you treat mindfulness as a kind of panacea that you apply to everybody. You know, this is again going back to some Willoughby and Jones' work and. There was an interesting review article that came out a few days ago that was making this point very strongly, among other points, and also pointing out that a lot of the research on mindfulness is pretty questionable and pretty lightweight, and it's time to be a bit more serious about all this. But my feeling is that, in a way, that what is going on within the mindfulness movement needs to be seen as part of something that's happening on a much wider scale and a much wider frame. So if mindfulness dies away and something else takes its place, that doesn't necessarily mean that things are changing all that much. I think there is, and I suppose one could call it a globalisation of knowledge at one level, that is part of the contemporary world and that works out in all sorts of aspects and processes, and I don't see that as reversing, really, because whether you like it or not, the world is getting more and more interconnected. It's just part of how things are. I think also, I mean, there's a certain tendency, certainly, for people within the certain areas of, say, Tibetan medicine or other parallel disciplines to look to Western science to validate what they're doing and say, look, we've discovered this, we can do this, etc. You know? And perhaps all of that doesn't need to be taken totally seriously. But some of it, maybe. But what I think is true here is that a lot of the people who are pushing these things in the West, I mean, this goes from mindfulness itself and goes back to, say, Jon Kabat-Zinn, who's become increasingly open in recent years about the Buddhist motivations behind what he's doing. And so whereas originally this was very much, we've got to make this look totally secular and innocent and non-Buddhist, otherwise nobody's going to do it, you know. And there does seem to have been quite an initial struggle politically to get it accepted even then. By now he's quite publicly saying that for him this is the way of bringing the Dharma to the West, you know, and so on. Well, okay, but I mean, I think the point that makes is that there are people who are certainly who are active within this whole sphere who are quite interested in going beyond the level of stress reduction and relaxation and introducing some of the more sophisticated concepts and goals of the tradition. I also, I mean, in a way, one thing I maybe didn't point to very strongly, but I think is interesting, is the kind of complementarity within the Tibetan tradition of the kind of goal of perfection, in a sense, the goal of optimum health, or whatever you want to call it, and the much more everyday and pragmatic problems that you might be dealing with medically or in other aspects of Tibetan practice. That it's not one or the other, necessarily. It's very much you can do one because of the other. They're seen as complementary in that sense. And I think that we do perhaps need more of a sense in Western society of what the optimum functioning of a human being might be, if you like. I don't think we know, and I think our images of it are pretty muddled and confused, and maybe this is an area where Buddhism and the other Asian traditions do have something to say. Maybe it's time we come to a stop.
Yeah.